causing pain and difficulty in Russia is never going to cause them to just say, okay, all right, we're going to stop fighting here. And even though no one can force us back on the front line and they can't stop us from going forward, we're going to choose to just go down because the pain is too great back in the rear. And you don't have to look any further than the Ukraine side to see why they wouldn't do that. Because the Ukraine side has for more than 2 years now just suffered enormous onslaughts of these long-range Russian drones and missile strikes all throughout the depth of their country with the glide bombs and all kinds of things that the Ukraine side doesn't have. And yet, that has never forced them to capitulate. In fact, it just creates the more motivation for them to find new ways to try to hit deeper into Russia to cause problems for Russia. But the compared to the scale is just so much less from the Ukraine side to the Russian side. If the much bigger onslaught hasn't knocked the Ukraine side out of the war, then a much smaller one in a much bigger country, there's no rational expectation that it's ever going to knock Russia out. You can cause them pain, you can cause them annoyance, you can increase the cost, but you can't reverse the situation. And you've got to, all of these things in the rear has to have an effect on the front line. If you can't reverse the forward momentum of the Russians, then there's no capacity and there's no reason why Russia would ever just say, well, the cost is going higher, so we're not going to fight in this. That is the reason why I think we pay too little attention to what Russia has monotonously said going back to 2014 to 2021, even before the war, and every day since. It's all about the root causes. They say it is an existential fight from their perspective, and it's the NATO inside of Ukraine. It's a hostile force on their border, and now then they've added the denazification criteria because they say that it's this hostile mentality on the Ukraine side that can't be allowed to exist. And so they say they will do whatever it takes, however long it takes, until all of those things are neutralized. And so just increasing the cost will just, I think, cause them to double down, just like it has caused Ukraine to double down and not be willing to submit because they view it correctly as an existential threat as well.
You're talking about those core issues, and I asked this to our common friend Colonel McGregor just a few days ago. If this is genuinely the reason for the war, and it's not territory, then why wouldn't Russia agree to the deal that was presented by Trump about freezing the lines as they are, as they negotiate the other issues? Why not freeze the lines, and why still throw so many lives and so much money now with the sanctions as well to continue gaining more territory and put Donbass as a negotiating chip that Russia would not accept peace unless they get the Donbass? If it's not territory, why do they need to get the entirety of Donbass?
Because it's people, and Russia has repeated this here just the last few days, Sergei Lavrov specifically. He said this is about people, and so it's the people inside of Ukraine that are on the Ukraine side of the line right now, and that's why they say part of their deal is that part of their negotiated requirements is that not just that they get the four administrative borders, which is what they're offering, but even those ethnic Russians on the other side of the line have to be given a change that's part of what they call the denazification, is that there has to be change in the constitution to give freedoms to the ethnic Russians, the ability to speak their language, etc. That's why they say that's a non-negotiable part of this. So it's the territory, but it's also the ethnic Russians on the rest of the territory. And if they don't get that, then they're going to continue going on. I actually interviewed Ambassador Polyansky on my show here a few weeks back, to where I point blank asked him that. And he said, yeah, we will just continue going on militarily if we don't get what we want at the negotiating table, what we need for our security. You can love it or hate it, but that's apparently their position. And I don't see any evidence on the ground that it's different than their words.
But there's also a strategic value for Pokrovsk and Kupiansk, especially Pokrovsk. That plays a key role. Now, Ukraine says that Russia wants the Donbass as the launching pad for future attacks, if that happens in the future. There's a lot of NATO fortifications in that region. Now, do you think there could be truth to that as well? A lot of minerals as well. I'm not sure if it's rare earth minerals or other minerals in that region. Could those play a role as well?
Yeah, without question, they do. There's no doubt that from a military perspective, if Russia genuinely wants to assure its security on its eastern flank, I'm sorry, on its western flank, then that's why the most logical place to go forward to is the Dnieper River. because it's a natural barrier, and you can defend it a lot easier than, you know, than building up your own fortified works. So that's why I've often said that if Ukraine would agree to the ugly deal on the table right now, and there's no way to sugarcoat it, giving up the administrative borders, which means it withdrawing from significant territories where the Ukraine side has, but that would get you to the administrative borders, which Putin is on the record of saying he would accept. If they don't take that, then the likelihood is that they Russians will not stop there, whether now or a year from now or even 2 years from now, until they get to that defensible border, which includes the Dnieper River and four additional oblasts. So that's what I think the options are between right now. And yes, definitely the Russians do want to have those areas. I mean, you can say they want it for a future jump off point. I think they just want it for a defensive point here, because not having those keeps them at more threat on their western flank.
Do you think they could give up territory? Because there's been reports as part of the deal, if Ukraine gives up the Donbass, Russia would give up territory in Zaporizhia and Kherson. Do you think that's on the table? Would Russia give up some of that territory?
I've heard that from Western sources and others who claim that they're talking behind it. I've not seen that mentioned by anybody in Russia, and any Russian sources that I have either interviewed or seen have said categorically not. That's already in the Russian constitution. Those people that are down there in the Zaporizhia and the Kherson, and they said that there's no way that we can negotiate that away. That's like saying we're going to negotiate away Russian territory, and they said it's impossible. I would be shocked if they did it. I guess anything's possible, but based on how emphatic the Russians are about people and all the stuff they say, I would be shocked if they actually offered something like that.
Let's talk about the most consequential development, and that's the sanctions on Russian oil companies, Rosneft and Lukoil. So that they control about two-thirds of Russia's oil exports, 4.4 million barrels per day. Your thoughts, because that does hit the Russian caches. It hits revenue by 30%, according to ex-executives on these companies. And I want to point out what I said earlier, that Chinese state majors, the four big companies, halted seaborne Russian crude oil. I think they're still buying some crude oil through pipes. About 20% of them is still being imported, but 80% of it has been halted. And India's halting imports as well as part of another deal. Again, that's going to hit profits and revenue by about 30%. Significant losses, and there's been reports that Lukoil is already selling a lot of their foreign assets as well.
Yeah, I'm in the camp that let's see how this plays out over time. I'm skeptical that both China and India are going to stop doing this trade just because we have some sanctions on there without doing some kind of workarounds. I would wager that, you know, the whole issue with the shadow fleet and all of which is a big area of focus on the Western side to try and shut that off, there will be those kinds of workarounds found. If there's not, then that's going to cause pain to Russia. But that's why I mentioned with some of these other things, even the strikes, they can have pain, but it's not as much as what the Ukraine side is suffering from direct military strikes. Russia will figure a way around this, like everybody does in war. There's always, you know, times where something happens unexpectedly. But I don't see any prospect that people can hang their hat on that, well, if they lose some money here, then that's going to force them to withdraw or decide not to go after these things. I think all it's going to do is say, Russia, all right, we're going to tighten our belts more. We're going to suffer. And they have a lot of history of doing this in their past, and they will suffer a lot, I think, if it gets down to it, and they will continue fighting. So I think it would increase the pain and increase the cost, but I do not think it's going to stop their onward movement. That's what I expect.
It reminds me of, do you remember the days when, in the early days in the war, when the ruble just collapsed, and then everyone thought the Russian economy has just come to an end and somehow just picked back up again? The Russian economy is still humming along. They do say, you know, reports, analysts do say this will have a pretty big hit on Russia in the short term. I think Putin even admitted it, if I'm not mistaken. But in the long term, yep, that will be mitigated through different means than, you know.
Right, because that's what they've always done. And then you also have to look at even India. Is India going to be able to maintain that? Because now all of a sudden, if they're stopping buying oil there, that means they got to buy it somewhere else at a higher rate. And that's not something that's going to be good for their economy. So we'll see if they also have some motivation to help work around, because they're going to do what's in their national interest as well. So that's why I say I'm going to wait and see how it actually plays out over time.
Yeah, there's another piece of quick news. There's a U.S. Elite electronic intelligence jet was spotted flying over the Black Sea. It's the first time that type of jet flies there. Apparently or allegedly, it's mapping S-400 radars and for attacking Storm Shadow missile strikes by Ukraine. So it's offering data, as you said, as we said, reported earlier, the U.S. is going to be offering more intelligence deep inside Russia for targets for Ukrainian missiles. So that could be the purpose of that jet, that intelligence jet that was flying close to Russian territory. But the piece of news that I want to dig into as well is what the Norwegian defense minister said, and that comes to the Kola Peninsula. I'm not sure if you've seen the Russian buildup there and how significant that is. He said the following: Russia is building up on the Kola Peninsula as preparation for war with NATO. He claims Putin wants the Arctic dominance for shipping routes. They've built out pretty significant stockpiles there. They've stacked nuclear warheads, nuclear-powered submarines, attack subs, different warships. They've tested hypersonic missiles there previously. They've got the Poseidon, the one we talked about earlier. The nuclear torpedo is present there as well. So Kola hosts 1,000 nuclear warheads, and there's apparently a lot of movement there, a lot of tests there, according to Norwegian defense minister. So not sure if you've been following the developments on the Kola Peninsula, but it kind of links to a broader question: is the risks of a direct conflict with NATO intentional or accidental? Especially the drone incursions we've seen previously, and the jet incursions, the jet that flew over, I think it was Estonia at the time, a few weeks ago. People have forgotten about it, and now we also have the balloons. I know it's different, but the Belarusian balloons flying over Lithuania, closing the airport 3 times in the last week, I think. So we are seeing NATO get more and more involved, whether they like it or not. I think there was even drones over Germany a few weeks ago. Does that concern you?
It does concern me, but the whole picture concerns me, because too many in the West want to look at all those things you mentioned, and I have seen some of them. I hadn't seen them all, but I've seen many of them, and we also have to look at the context with which they exist, and there is two sides of the story that's going on here, because, you know, you have the West talking about, hey, we have this rebuild and rearm in Europe, this $800 billion thing. You have the NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg, Mark Rutte, talking emphatically, you know, over the past several months that we have to be ready to fight a war with Russia, you know, in 3 years, 5 years, 7 years. That's practically tomorrow. We have to start increasing all of our defense spending right now. The Germans have moved a brigade onto the Lithuania, closer to the Russian border. You have the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff for France, for Germany, both saying we'll probably have to fight Russia, so we have to start getting ready right now, etc. So the Russian side, they see all of this boisterous military movement, these claims of accelerating their defense budgets, moving troops closer to Russia. They will react to it, and they are reacting to it. And so a lot of this expansion of the Russian armed forces to up to somewhere around 1.5 million by the end of December is in part not for the fighting of the special military operation, as they call it, but to potentially get ready for war with NATO. And I can just tell you, many people that I've talked to privately on the Russian side claim that they think that it's inevitable, that they believe that the NATO is getting ready to fight them, and that they're consequently getting ready to fight back. And so a lot of these areas, they're building up bases closer to NATO territory. They are doing that. That's a fact. It's not a threat. They are doing that.
It's scary to imagine.
It is terrifying to imagine, because too many people on both sides of this equation, the minute that you start getting into this mentality that war is inevitable, then you keep taking action. And then every action you take, you see the other side is doing something and you say, aha, that validates it. So now let me do more. I mean, it's a slower motion, but it's not too dissimilar for how we got into World War I. And we don't need to get into that again. And I think I'm very alarmed by it, to answer your original question, because I see both sides taking actions that feed the fears of the other side and make war more possible.
And there's also been reports that the UK and France are in talks to provide Germany with a nuclear umbrella. And that's kind of Germany moving away from the reliance on the US. We saw Trump's stance on NATO, shifting American stance on the alliance. We also have Germany announcing that a 377 billion euro military modernization plan. So that includes the purchase of 400 Tomahawk missiles, long range strike, 561 Sky Ranger air defense systems, different drones, and building an army, 300,000 strong army. And they want to become Europe's top conventional force by 2035. Last time we spoke, Colonel, we talked about Chinese capabilities versus the US, and that was a long discussion we had. Everyone loves to dismiss Europe now, economically, but also militarily. I think it's becoming, people are going too far with it. It's getting a bit unfair. We're still talking about pretty significant militaries in Europe. They're a significant economy. They're still bigger than the Russian economy, as combined, UK, France, Germany, etc. France, the UK have military nuclear warheads. Germany has incredible nuclear capability. Military capabilities. How would you compare Europe's military abilities compared to Russia?
Well, let's look at it from two perspectives. One is the strategic and one is the conventional. From the strategic, you have effective parity right now already, because once you get past a handful of nuclear weapons, it becomes superfluous. It doesn't matter. So it doesn't matter if you have 6,000 or 600. I mean, once you get through Somari, it's not going to make any difference. So you have effective parity in terms of deterrence already at the strategic level. Getting more is not going to change that. At the conventional level, though, you have a lot of aspiration on the European side, but you have actual production on the Russian side, because that's why I talked about a minute ago how important experience was. Russia has burned away a lot of their ridiculous ideas that they had at the beginning, a lot of their theories that they had about how to use this, the battalion tactical groups or whatever. It seemed really cool on paper, but it was disaster the way it unfolded in modern warfare. So they've completely redone a lot of that. Ukraine did the same thing. They've adjusted to the modern, especially the infusion of the various levels of drones at every level and how that coordinates on the ground. Russia has now expanded their military significantly, and they are equipped with the things that it needs right now. They have the mentality and they understand the speed of operations that go into the counteraction, counteraction, reaction, et cetera, this whole cycle and coming up with new things that work. That is, you just can't replicate that. On this side, we don't have that yet. They're talking about over some number of years to having a budget that's going to meet up to that point. But until you're actually threatened, you're not going to have that motivation to get it done. And the UK still, they're going to be lucky if they can put right now, if they could field a one full armored division, period, anywhere. And France has a little bit more than that, but not a whole lot more. And none of them have any combat experience. So it's going to take a long time to actually put forth the infrastructure that's necessary and then do the training, the modern training that's, it's tough, it's difficult, it's based on all these lessons that are learned over here. And you have to have the mentality on the fighter side. The people who are joining up have to have that same mentality, because whatever Russians had and whatever Ukrainians had prior to 2022, it is radically different today, because it's been burned out through death and your life is on the line. So that will focus you like nothing. That focus doesn't exist over here yet. Doesn't exist in America right now either. So those are kind of intangibles that you can't measure, you can't quantify, et cetera, are profoundly important in deciding who wins the wars actually on the ground. So I would say that conventionally we are way, way behind the curve, and it would take more than a decade of really concerted effort and across the board in maintenance or organization and training to actually get up to where you could really compete well with the Russian side.
I want to go back to what happened earlier in the week with Trump's negotiation attempts to a peace deal in this war. So he initially, he planned to meet Putin in Budapest. And before they had a meeting with Zelensky, but before that, he spoke to Putin. And the threats of supplying Tomahawk missiles to Ukraine disappeared right after that call with Putin. So I'm curious what Putin would have told him, in your opinion, for that threat, for that plan to be shelved. Then we have Trump allegedly meeting with Zelensky, shouting at Zelensky, saying he's sick of seeing the front lines, trying to have Zelensky accept a peace deal offered by Putin that we discussed earlier, which is give up Luhansk, which Russia already controls, and Donetsk, which Russia controls about 70-something%. And Russia would freeze the lines or give up some territory in Kherson, Zaporizhia, most likely freeze the lines. So that was the deal that was offered by Russia. And Ukraine and Europe seem to have rejected that deal, and they just want to freeze the lines where they are today. And right after that, Trump shifted his narrative, canceled the meeting with Rubio, spoke to Lavrov. After that call, which apparently no development, so I'm guessing Russia stood their ground. Ukraine, we know their position and European position. So after that meeting between Rubio and Lavrov, the meeting between Trump and Putin got canceled, or at least delayed for now. And it was the White House that announced the cancellation. Russia initially was saying, no, it's still going ahead. They still wanted the meeting to happen. Symbolically, it's, optically, it's good for Putin. But it's not happening. And right after that, we saw the sanctions that we talked about earlier, probably the most significant sanctions in a while against Russia, against the Russian oil companies, trying to hurt Putin where it matters, hurting him in that piggy bank. What are your thoughts on Trump's negotiating tactic as a whole? From the outside, it looks, you know, it looks like just kind of basic carrot and stick approach. Like, hey, accept the deal. I'll meet you. I'll say great things about you. You say no. All right. I'll talk shit about you. I'll say Russia's weak. I'll say Russia's losing the war. Make fun of how you didn't win the war two and a half years ago. You couldn't get Kiev. Your military's weak. Your economy's about to collapse. You're about to do a deal. Great. You're a great guy. Your economy's doing well. Your military's strong. We're going to do a great deal. Zelensky, you're a Nazi. While it is funny to watch, but it seems to be it worked in Gaza, where he's talking about the Gaza Riviera, but then he kind of walks back those statements, and now we have a deal in Gaza. Could we see the same thing in Ukraine? Do you like his negotiating strategy, or not so much?
I wouldn't say we have a deal in Gaza. I'd say we have a tentative ceasefire only, but all of the more difficult things haven't even been negotiated. So I wouldn't put that in the win column yet.
We're still at phase one.
He did get a ceasefire. So good on that, because without a phase one, we can't even get to a phase two. So I'm happy about that. But in this particular situation right here, I mean, forgive me for laughing while you're talking, because when you say it all in context like that, it sounds kind of funny, but that's an accurate representation of what we have seen here. And I'm just telling you, that is no serious way to conduct negotiations, because it's not founded on anything other than a transactional modus operandi for the moment. And when the moment changes, well, then everything else changes. But that's not how strategy works. And that's definitely not how the Russians work. And if you want to get the Russians to do something, it's got to be something that's grounded in reality and something that can be a win-win, that both have some reason to think that there's the end state is something we can live with. And these transactions things are good for the moment. But I think one of the reasons why this thing has completely failed is because that the Russians are saying, I haven't changed my position since 2014 or 2021, and certainly not since Istanbul in 2022. They are literally the same thing every time. They said it, repeated the same version this past week. And so I think that my assessment anyway is that Russia does continue to want to talk to Trump. They do continue to say nice things about him, even now, even after some of these sanctions, because they know at least he's willing to talk, whereas his predecessor wouldn't. So there's no possibility of anything there. And if they also recognize the transactional nature of Trump, and if they can somehow get him to agree to something that they get what they want, then that's a win. And I think they'll keep trying to go down that path. And certainly we see the same, and Zelensky is trying to do the same to Trump. NATO leaders are trying to do, Keir Starmer, Macron, they all try to butter up Trump, et cetera. Everybody's trying to manipulate him into doing what they want. And sometimes it seems to be working one way and then the other, but there's no solidity to it. So he just moves wherever the wind blows. And you mentioned this Tomahawk issue. Some people were saying, well, it was the threat of Trump's Tomahawk a week before that phone call where he says, yeah, I may put those Tomahawks in there. If Putin doesn't do what I want, I may give them to Ukraine. They may do that. And then, of course, that Wednesday, they're off the table. I don't think they're off the table because Putin came in and said anything to him other than what the Russians themselves said in the readout was that, well, we told him it's not going to make any difference on the battlefield. It's not going to change the dynamics, but it will harm our relationships long term. I think that's probably true. I think they probably did convey that. But I think that the real issue was that on our side, that some of our leaders told, the military leaders told Trump that, hey, we don't have that many of these things. And the number that we can give, and for a while they floated somewhere between 20 and 50. You may have seen that in the Western media. That's nothing. That's not going to do anything. I mean, Russia fires that many in a day sometimes. 20 or 50
20, Tomahawk 50. Missiles.
Yeah. That's what they said we might be willing to give. That was before they got taken off the table.
That wouldn't make much of a difference at all.
Oh, not at all. No, I mean, Russia fires that many in a night very often, sometimes even more so missiles I'm talking about. So that's not going to make any difference. And apparently Trump said, okay, yeah, we can't do that because we don't have enough, which is what I said from the beginning. We don't have that many. So we certainly shouldn't give them to the Ukraine side because that could expand the war and it's going to draw down our inventory should we ever need them. So that would be a bad move. And I think Trump recognized that. So I don't think it was that Russia talked him out of it. I think that our side said, hey, sir, this is not a good move. We don't have enough of these. Don't do that. If you want to use it as a pretend carrot and stick and, you know, and threaten Russia, okay, that's fine. But we can't really give it to them because it's not going to make any difference. And it's going to draw down our own inventory below threshold.
The last thing I want to ask you about, Colonel, is just a report of what's happening in Venezuela. So there's a Wagner-linked plane that landed in Venezuela. Mm-hmm. There's reports that some people say it's humanitarian and aid, but that's unlikely because it went through various countries first, Algeria and I think Libya, I can't remember what countries, before going to Venezuela to avoid sanctions. So it's most likely has mercenaries, and we know there's already a couple of hundred Wagner-linked fighters in Venezuela helping Maduro's military. But the most likely scenario is it had some small arms, parts for their S-300 defense systems, drones, etc. And that happened not long after Russia ratified the agreement, the strategic agreement with Venezuela. Essentially, the agreement includes selling Venezuela more S-300s, different jets, older jets, training troops, selling Kalashnikovs. What are your thoughts on what we're seeing in some financial deals, like, you know, de-dollarization deals to avoid using the US dollar and the SWIFT system? What do you think of what's happening in Venezuela? Does that concern you? And do you think Russia do they have an incentive in the US getting dragged into Venezuela? And would they support Venezuela in that scenario? Because that will move away US focus on Ukraine and US the ability for the US to supply weapons to Ukraine.
Let's focus on the last part of your question there. First of all, Russia has shown pretty conclusively that they're willing to help lots of countries and they're allowed to engage in different areas, especially financially, economically, but not militarily. I mean, they didn't help Syria against when it was attacked. They didn't help Iran. So I don't think that militarily they're going to help Venezuela either. Now, they may give them some spare parts. They may give them some assets, but I don't think that they're going to engage in any effect. To your other question, yeah, I'm very worried about it because all I see is that there is this lust of certain groups in Washington for regime change. The Trump administration tried it ham-fistedly with the supporting a coup in Trump's first administration. John Bolton was led that way with Juan Guaido and all that. Famous disaster. You know, we just did a terrible job with it and it failed. And he ends up getting more strength than Maduro does in the aftermath of that. Now then it looks like there's people are saying, all right, our mistake then was we didn't use the military. This time we're going to use the military and we're selecting this new opposition leader to be the next one that's going to, now we're going to put in charge, et cetera. And Maduro apparently recognized the seriousness of this. And then he practically offered the farm with, you can have our oil infrastructure. You can do all this stuff basically as long as I stay in charge. And Trump famously used the F word because he didn't want that. That's not the deal he wants. He wants to get rid of Maduro, it appears.
Which makes no sense. But why is that? Colonel, but why is that? Why is that? If they get everything economically, why not continue doing business with the current regime? I know it's not the best regime. Me and you can criticize Maduro forever, but then it's not our business, not America's business, not any country's business for regime change. It just never works. If Maduro's willing to give access to oil and the minerals, doesn't that solve, especially Trump loves to make deals and he wants to be the peace president. I don't understand. What am I missing here? Why would they, again, so taking into consideration, the US has not struck Venezuela. Maybe they're pressuring Venezuela for further concessions. Hopefully that's the case. That'll be my bet because I can't imagine Trump with all his focus on the Nobel Peace Prize and making deals around the world and taking credit for them, that he'll start a war just on America's borders in the South. But if it is the case, what's the benefit for a regime change if Maduro is already offering everything economically?
I cannot come up with one answer to your question. It is puzzled me. It is baffling to me, other than there's just a lust for regime change down there. They don't want to get some of the, I perceive that these group, that they don't want to get some of Venezuela's oil. They want full control of it. And they think that they can probably get it through this other leader here, because there's nothing else that makes any sense. That should have been the easiest win that you can imagine, that you get what you want. You don't have to spend any money for it, just the threat of military force, et cetera. And instead we get mad about that, use the F word. And then we're talking about regime change. And I mean, by name, Lindsey Graham is just almost beside himself, going on all the U.S. television networks over and over. He was on Meet the Press, and he just said, yes, we need to, Maduro must go, et cetera. And he said that when Trump gets back from this Asia trip, that he's going to brief members of Congress on both Venezuela and Colombia. I don't know why we're now adding Colombia into this mix. But listen, you look at the amount of combat power we have there. It's a lot, but it's not near enough to have any kind of sustained combat operations. You can blow a bunch of stuff up, and we've got the aircraft and the air wing and the missile frigates and all that. So we can blow the hell out of a lot of stuff. But with just a very small number of marine amphibious unit guys that can go on shore, there's not many that can do anything much on the ground, unless you literally just want to kill Maduro and you want to use all that firepower to kill him. And then, I mean, that is just so heinous of an idea to just say, yes, we're just going to go kill this guy because we don't like him, and blow him up, and whoever else dies. I pray to God that doesn't actually happen, because, I mean, again, saying that out loud, it's like that's one of the most detestable things you can imagine, what we used to stand against.
Yeah, exactly. The international system that allowed the US and allies to prosper over the last few decades is now being broken, if that's the case. If we just go there and strike, it's like what Israel did in Qatar. There's certain red lines you don't cross. You don't just strike. If you're an American ally, you don't just strike another American ally that has the biggest American military base in the Middle East. If you're aiming for a regime change in Venezuela because you don't like the current regime, you don't just strike the president of a neighboring country, of a pretty large neighboring country. And then the question goes on is, then what? Because we all know, as we saw in Iran, if you're aiming for a regime change, a regime that's not popular will become popular if threatened by another country. We saw that with Iran and Israel. Israel was hoping for people to rise against the regime. Instead, the people went on the streets supporting the regime. Fingers crossed, Colonel, we won't be doing another show after Venezuela was struck. We are getting reports, or I think it's not even reports anymore. The U.S. is saying they may strike a Venezuela, deep inside Venezuela, no longer on the shores and the sea. Hopefully it's not the case, but we'll see. But Colonel, always a pleasure, sir. Thank you.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.